When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, Rude Boys and Rude Girls. We got a skankin' great episode lined up for you. Today's guest is guitarist and vocalist Rob Bucket Hingley from New York City ska legends, The Toasters. Together, we break down the writing, recording, and inspiration behind the fan-favorite single, Two Tone Army, taken from their 1996 album, Hard Band for Dead. Bucket has been flying the ska flag since the late 70s, and with The Toasters since their 1981 inception. This tune is everything you could want in a ska song. The horn hook is infectious. The lyrics are about openness, unity, and acceptance within the scene, and a gang vocal chorus that is instantly catchy. I told Bucket that it feels like a live song, a tune they had been playing for a while before the record button was even thought of being pressed. And I was right. The song worked live, and it worked just as well on the record. So for all this and a whole lot more, don't touch that dial.
Heard Krista makes a podcast. Hey, have you heard Krista makes a podcast? Hey, have you heard Krista makes a podcast? Hey, have you heard Krista makes a podcast?
Well, hey there, Buck.
Here we are again.
Here we are again. Thanks for sitting in. You know, before we started rolling, we were talking that we saw each other last year quite a bit in 2023. We did a bunch of shows, Toasters Less Than Jake, United States, as well as the UK. And then we were also talking about the time prior to that, which was this weird, like, summer music festival in of all places, Topeka, Kansas.
Yeah, Topeka, Kansas. That was definitely not on my bingo card for 2020. It's kind of hard. It's hard for me to remember what was pre-COVID and what wasn't.
Yeah, that was pre-COVID. That was around 2017.
That's already 7 years ago. It's pretty crazy.
I know. You know, and I've had a couple of my friends on the show that it's funny, you know, backstage, how many times have we hung out? And I've never asked you some of the questions that I want to ask you, you know, and I want to pick your brain kind of as a fan, you know, going back. And we had talked about this recently. I said, so you're telling me the first time I saw the Toasters in 92, you guys had only been a band for 11 years at that point.
Where was that? Like down in Florida?
Yeah, that was at the Florida Theater there in Gainesville.
Oh, wow. I think that was the show where the KKK guys showed up outside. Did I ever tell you that story?
You did. And we talked about that. And I say recently, probably within the last half a decade or so. You kind of, I don't remember the whole thing, but yeah, that was definitely an issue back then.
Well, it was strange. There was the KKK was having a rally in Gainesville that week. And we had a couple of like sharp skinhead guys who were our roadies back then. And they said, hey, we got a bit of an issue at the front door. I said, what is it? He says, well, a whole bunch of like KKK guys want to come in the show. I said, man, I got to come and hear this rationale. It's like these guys want to pay some money to see the brothers sing, you know, and Sledge playing the trumpet. And so I went out and said, what's up with you guys? And the guy goes, yeah, we just want to come and see the show. We're big fans. We like the music. And we're not racists. We're just bigots.
That is so ridiculous because during that time, Buck, I mean, you know, Gainesville was like the one blue spot on the map. It was this little hippie town, you know, and I know some of the redneck towns that surround Gainesville. There was talk of some good old boys out there burning crosses or doing whatever garbage they were doing. But
that's probably why they did it there. I mean, I'm sure those people weren't from Florida. They were from somewhere else, but I'm sure they did that on purpose. But that was very weird. I mean, and that was, you know, that was only like, I mean, I guess 30 years ago now. Goodness me. But it's kind of strange to me just being in that situation, thinking, well, what century are we in that this kind of thing is still happening in the USA? But of course, you know, here we are in 2024 and not a lot not a lot has changed.
I know. That's, you know, I was thinking about that too when we did that Ska Against Racism tour. That was in April of 1998.
Yeah.
And I was thinking by then, you know, hey, you know, things are starting to mellow out. You know, people are starting to accept people. We're obviously in the punk and ska scene. It's, you know,
yeah,
as much as it could be, it was that way. You always had the odd knucklehead or idiot that showed up. But for the most part, yeah, I remember doing that tour in 98 thinking, I think we're on a right path here. And here we are 20 years later. It seems like taking a couple steps backwards.
Well, it all made a roaring comeback with You Know Who. You know, I'm not going to invoke his name on this program, but I mean, it's like, I think with the current political climate, a lot of those people who'd kind of gone in underground of feel like validated, and they're back with a bang. These people, it's like, you know, they didn't go away. They were just waiting for their guy.
Right. Well, going back to when you guys started, I mean, I'm thinking back to 81, and of course you're from England, and I know you know saw Madness and the Specials, English Beat, what became Special Beat, all of this stuff. But what was the climate of ska in New York in 1981? I mean, I'm trying to think of bands that would even have been kicking around. Were the New York Citizens around yet?
I got here in 1980, and at that point there weren't any still working ska bands in New York City. There had been one two-tone era called The Terrorists in New York City, but I think they'd stopped playing before I had gotten here. So for me, like, nobody, you know, I was all like, yeah, two-tone this and this and that, and people were like, what is that? And I was like, wow. So, you know, but I realized that two-tone music had not really been promoted at all in the USA, and I think it's because the industry at that time didn't have a pigeonhole where they could put that type of music, which is black and white people playing music together. I mean, it didn't fit in any of their marketable categories. And I thought that, you know, in a way it was like a little bit too dangerous for people to even entertain the idea of like mixing up, like having a mixed race band like that. It's pretty crazy. And I was like, wow, you know, because, you know, coming from Europe, I would have thought that, you know, America would have been way more societally advanced than Europe, but it didn't turn out to be the case culturally. So coming over in the 80s and, you know, when I found out I was going to be here for more than the 6 months that was originally planned, I thought, well, I'll put a band together just to have something to do and, you know, just have a project to do after work. And so I started a ska band and I was telling people, we're going to play this. And they're like, what is that? I was like, goodness me, you never heard of two-tone. You've never heard of like Bob Marley or reggae or all this stuff. So it was like kind of really having to like musically educate a lot of people. I mean, there was a huge punk rock thing in New York City with like post Johnny Thunders era and the Richard Hell and the Voidoids and the New York Dolls and all that kind of stuff. And the hardcore scene was just starting to get on its feet. You know, bands like Agnostic Front and Murphy's Law, Madball, all that kind of stuff. Well, Madball were a little later. So it was kind of like a pretty interesting time in New York with all these things going on. And ska music was like an unknown quantity for people. So finding people who knew what it was or knew how to play it was difficult at the beginning.
Do you think that's how the morph came later on? With the ska punk?
Yeah. In the early days in New York as well, we played with a lot of hardcore bands and punk bands. In fact, our first show was opening up. We opened up for Bad Brains. That was the first show we played in New York City in 1981. So that's not a bad place to jump off. And then we used to do hardcore matinees or like weekends down at CBGB's where they would put a hardcore matinee on Sunday afternoon, and we put a ska show on Saturday night. So people would come from out of town to see both of the shows. So there was quite a lot of collaboration between the scenes at that time. That was one of the best things about it.
You guys were releasing singles during this period. Your first single, Beat Up, came out in 1983. You had a debut EP called Recriminations in 1985.
Yeah, that's Joe Jackson produced that record for us.
I noticed that, and I never knew that. That is so cool. But so the 6 years you were getting your footing releasing EPs, your first record, Ska Boom, came out in 87. Now, did you feel you didn't need a full length till that time, or were you just amassing songs?
Well, it's like we were writing material and playing live, and of course, like we didn't have like 10 cents to scratch our backsides with at that point. And the Recriminations album, which was like really well produced, and like 4-song EP that Joe Jackson had helped us with, and like was a really professional product that we got national distribution for that through Relativity, which was in India at that point. But I was taking that round record labels to shop it, and basically getting, laughed out of their office saying, oh, you're not going to get anywhere playing that circus music or this. So there was no support whatsoever in the music business to sign a ska band and fund a project. So we basically just ended up doing it ourselves.
I noticed, after Joe Jackson had produced the EP, that everything since then you produced. And I wanted to ask you why. Did you ever want to work with somebody else, or you're just like, I know what my band sounds like, and I don't need anybody else?
Well, Joe Jackson worked with us again on the Throw Me Up album. He produced that, and he also produced the New York Fever album. So he was heavily involved in the first three records, and then in the mid '90s when we put out that triptych of albums like Dub 56. And Hard Band for Dead and Don't Let the Bastards Grind You Down, we were working with a German engineer called Matthias Schneeberger, who we'd met in Berlin when we'd done the session with Joe Jackson recording there. So there was some continuity working with other people there. But I've also always been heavily involved, because it's like I feel that kind of I know where I want the sound to go better than other people sometimes.
Sure. And Wikipedia let me down again, Buck, because I did not notice going through the records. They all say produced by you. Matt Malice, bass player, who, of course, I know very well, he's credited as a co-producer on one of the records, which made me laugh. But I do want to jump into the track now. Two-Tone Army is the first track on your 6th studio album, Hard Band for Dead, which came out in 96. You guys were just a machine during this period. Your previous record, Dub 56, came out in 94, and of course you were on the road this whole time. Lead off track on the album, 3:19. There's a 6-bar intro. This whole intro is kind of weird because it goes 6 bars before the horn hook hits. Right off the top, we get a snare hit, and the first 2 bars are drums, bass, and a guitar panned off to the left. On bar 3, another guitar panned off to the right joins the mix, and on bar 5, we hear a swell of an organ panned off left before the horns come in. And I'm hearing, and I couldn't find anything online, and I know your different touring histories, Buck, of different horn configurations, but I'm definitely hearing a trombone and a trumpet here, and I believe a sax. Is that right?
Yeah, there was a 3-piece horn section, Sledge on trumpet, Rick Faulkner on trombone, and Freddie Reiter on sax, who's now in New York Sky Jazz Ensemble. So that was that, and Dave Barry on the keyboard. But I basically ripped that introduction off the Selector on my radio. That's a drum riff from my radio by Selector. So I stole that, basically, and built on that. The whole way that tune came about, it was kind of interesting because when we were in the studio basically rehearsing and tracking that record, we had been contacted by Nickelodeon, which was a MTV-related channel in New York, and they had had a cartoon show called Kablam, which they had contracted Bad Manners to do the music for, and Buster had like backed out at the last minute and left them hanging. So they said, can you write a theme song for this show? And so they sent me a whole bunch of the cartoons, and it was like a hoot. And so I was starting to write something for them, which was like a little bit more, I mean, not circusy so much, but more upbeat and cartoony. And I made like a country and western riff that was the same melody as Two Tone Army. And so the whole Two Tone Army tune came out of writing the theme song for that program. And I thought, wow, I'm going to turn this into this guitar riff into a ska anthem song, and I'm going to call it Two Tone Army. And that's, so basically I've just got the whole idea from the cartoon show to write that tune.
Well, that's awesome. The horn hook is just catchy as all get out. And I got to ask, what liberty did you give or did your horn players have to come up with parts? Like, did you hum that and that was the horn part? Did you write that, or, you know, what was it, organic? How did it come about?
I wrote most of the horn parts on that record, or at least I had the horn line. Say, here's what I want you to play. You figure out who's going to play what and you know, embellish it. But the whole thing was, the line is do 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 do. That was the introduction to the show, and the guy would say, "Welcome to Kablam," whatever. So it was kind of like, it was almost like writing a jingle or a commercial. So the whole, a lot of the writing was, you know, can you do a 6-second bumper to fiddle in this hole and a 12-bar intro for this? So it's the whole tune came together like that, and the whole horn line was just a piece of bumper music for the program.
It's Kablam, where cartoons and comics collide. Now to take you inside and turn the pages, here are your hosts, Henry and June.
It's kind of interesting how that tune came into being, because it started being something else.
Something else that strikes me about this song, and I've heard it numerous times over the years, but when I got it under the microscope here, it feels like a live song. And what I mean by that is the arrangement's a little wacky, especially when we get to the end, the outro, and how it doesn't move back to the chorus, and we'll get there. But I get the sense of, and we used to do this. I remember when we started working with producers, I remember getting scolded one time. They're like, we're making a record, it doesn't matter live. And I'm like, yeah, but I'm always going to think about it live. We're a live band. Yeah. I want to know how it's going to translate to the audience. And when I hear this song, I don't hear a lot of like, we should double this chorus at the end. It's like, no, no, no. And I think that's why the horn hook is in here so much, because it's the catchiest thing ever.
Yeah, we had a whole bunch of the guys who worked for Moon Records come in the studio and just like march in the studio on the wood floor to get that whole like marching sound. That was all the guys working for me at the label came in to do that. And but it was like, when I was a kid, I used to go see this band called Sham 69, Jimmy Percy. Have you heard of those?
Of course,
guys?
Yeah. We played with Sham 69.
They wrote anthemic tunes like that, which didn't necessarily have like a super strong structure. And I think, you know, I think I never saw him play the same tune the same way twice when I went to see him. So it was just something I thought, well, this is like, this tune is going to be like a cartoon. It's going to be really anarchic and maybe not have the same kind of format as some of the other tunes, because at that point, everybody was trying to craft the perfect song and fit everything in. And it's got to have the intro and the outro and a middle eight and a pre-chorus and all this kind of stuff. I said, well, let's just make a tune that does what it wants to do. And that's what ended up coming out.
That's awesome. Well, we get 16 bars of that horn hook before we hit verse one. I got to tell you, the guitar interplay here is killer. You know, a lot of bands, myself included, we had one guitar player. So, you know, we'd kind of chuck the clean guitar over here in the left speaker, a little bit panned, and that's what you got. And here you got a stereo image going on, but it's not a perfect stereo. There's a lot of interplay between the what's going on with the right guitar and the left guitar. I love it because I come from that same kind of style of playing. My father was a guitar player. He could play all that 50s stuff, and it sounds very 50s, 60s, what you're going for there. It's not just traditional upstrokes.
I did all of those guitar parts myself. And so basically on one track, there's just like the traditional, well, you know, toaster style ska beat, which is, you know, I think at that point we were playing it a little bit more aggressively than a lot of the other guys in the States who were like coming out of a more of a trad ska or reggae feel. But I basically, you know, coming out of London and, you know, punk rock was like a massive influence to me. I mean, I actually went to the Anarchy in the UK tour at Leeds University and saw that and was pretty blown away. So I play in a ska band, but really I grew up playing like rhythm and blues and rock music. So that's what the other guitar on that track is, with those heavy hits. Bam, 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 bam. You know, I like The Who. I like Pete Townsend, guitar players like that, you know.
Well, almost 30 years later, the guitar tones on this sound killer. They sound awesome. I don't know what else you could have done. Whatever combo you had there, I'm assuming it sounds like a Tele through like a Fender Twin or something. It's beautiful.
Yeah, a Tele and a Twin, and you're a Tele guy, aren't you?
Yeah, you got it.
I've actually just rebuilt the guitar that I used in that session that had like succumbed to, you know, rock and roll and sweat and abuse on the road. And it's it's actually a reissue of the Buddy Holly boat neck. So it's a Tele that has like the fat round neck that has a lot more sustain. I don't know if you've seen that.
Yeah, and I've never played one, but I know what you're talking about. That's awesome.
I have it right here. But it's just
it's beautiful.
Yeah. But it has the neck. I don't know if you can see. It doesn't have the flat back that most Tele necks have. It's a round neck.
It's rounded.
Yeah, and they call it the boat neck. So this was reissued in 1983 on the anniversary of Buddy Holly's death, and my wife actually bought me this, so I think that's why I married her. Because you bought me this guitar, but I just had it rebuilt.
That is beautiful.
But that's the guitar that I used on that session. So it has that Fender sound, but it has like way more sustain than a normal Tele.
There's a new Bob that's going around. Gonna blast shock waves all over your town. Take your old system and knock it down. With a 90s beat on a 50s sound. They're wearing bomber flights, combat boots, skater pants and 60s.
There's a new bug that's going around, gonna blast shock waves all over your town. Take your own system and knock it down with a 90s beat on a 50s sound. They're wearing bomber flights, combat boots, skater pants, and 60s suits in a lifestyle that is hard to refute. It's a modern look, but it's all about the roots.
Yeah, there you go. And that was just a shout out to what was happening in the 90s, where basically ska music in the USA had morphed into this manifestation that had all these kind of different looks to it. So it was not just like Rude Boys and Skinheads. It was like the ska punk guys and the skater kids and all these different people who were coming into the scene and widening it and, you know, just enabling that whole crazy ska punk explosion. I mean, who knew? Who knew that was going to happen and go off like it did? I mean, I wished I'd signed the Boston's and Rancid when they came to Moon Records with their crappy demos back in the day. I should have said, yeah. the ones that got away. But I mean, I think the lyrics on the tune are just to have a nod to all the like the various factions of people who came together to make that crazy, crazy scene we had back in the day.
That's killer. Well, we got both those stereo guitars happening here with the bass and the drums. Great groove on verse one. I got to ask, you know, I know there's some swells here and there, but are the keys doing upstrokes with the guitars there? If they are, it's mixed brilliantly and super tight because I can't really hear it.
Yeah, Dave Barry, that keyboard, he's a monster. And what I like about him is he grew up playing in a lot of salsa bands and Latin bands in New York. So when he plays the keyboards, he's playing as part of the rhythm section. And he's not rushing in to fill up all the holes like a lot of keyboard players do. They're like overplay in a sense. But when you have the horn section, it's great to have a keyboard player who can let them do the fills and just have the organ player playing in the rhythm section. Because he also plays percussion. And so it's fantastic to have that. So it's like you have like the extra rhythm instrument going there.
The organ, as you know, can be very percussive in nature.
Yeah. Well, he was playing, I mean, in the studios, normally we had this Hammond B3, but he also had the Hammond C3 that he'd bring on the road. And he played that thing like he was chopping wood with it. It was like great, great player. I don't know if you had the chance to see him play, but fantastic, fantastic player.
He was out with you on Ska Against Racism.
Yeah, so that guy. So he's kind of the go-to guy. And I haven't really, you know, after having played with him, it's like people say, why don't you have a keyboard? And I said, well, find me one I like and I'll hire him. But I mean, you know, after having played with Dave Barry, the bar is set very high.
Well, either that was the answer, or the answer was we don't have room in the van. I mean, ska bands are big.
Yeah. And Dave Barry, he was playing with Matt Malice in Second Step back in the day, and then in another New York ska band called the Beat Brigade. So it's all roads lead back to Matt Malice, you know. Matt Malice is the Kevin Bacon of the ska community.
Two-tone army, go ahead, go ahead. Two-tone army, go ahead, go ahead. Two-tone army, go ahead, go ahead. There's gang vocals on everything here. It's really loose and fun, though. It's not super tight. You could tell this wasn't recorded to a grid. It was to tape. All the vocals besides the lead seem slightly panned off to the right, too, a little bit. Like I said, this just feels like a live band.
Yeah, well, that's the way you wanted to do it. And you know, we had Cooley Ranks in that outfit, and so I tried to give him as much latitude as I could in terms of freestyling and doing things which were, you know, not pre-programmed. So we were just used to having him go off and, like, you know, and just extend a session, like extemporize, you know. And so that whole band, it was so tight. We just played off each other a lot, and that's how a lot of those arrangements ended up being freestyle in a sense.
Hey everybody, don't go anywhere. We got lots more with Bucket coming right up after a few words from our sponsors. One Hit Thunder is a podcast where we both celebrate and have a good laugh about bands and artists that had just one hit that we all know. Each week, we're joined by a guest from the world of music or comedy to learn more than you ever thought you would about some songs that you can't forget. And we decide if they brought the one-hit thunder or were nothing more than a one-hit blunder. Look, if you listen to the show, you're probably going to laugh, and I guarantee you're going to crush next time the bar has music trivia. Tag Team, Jane Child, Meredith Brooks, Looking Glass, Sean Mullins, Eiffel 65, EMF, Crash Test Dummies, Crazy Town, Chumbawamba. We have hundreds of episodes in our back catalog and a new episode each week, so pass the Dutchie, make sure you're connected, and subscribe to One Hit Thunder wherever you get your pods. One Hit Thunder is a podcast where we both celebrate and have a good laugh about bands and artists that had just one hit that we all know. Each week, we're joined by a guest from the world of music or comedy to learn more than you ever thought you would about some songs that you can't forget. And we decide if they brought the one-hit thunder or were nothing more than a one-hit blunder. Look, if you listen to the show, you're probably going to laugh, and I guarantee you're going to crush next time the bar has music trivia. Tag Team, Jane Child, Meredith Brooks, Looking Glass, Sean Mullins, Eiffel 65, EMF, Crash Test Dummies, Crazy Town, Chumbawamba. We have hundreds of episodes in our back catalog and a new episode each week. So pass the Dutchie, make sure you're connected, and subscribe to One Hit Thunder wherever you get your pods. And now, back to the show.
I have to ask, because I texted Malice yesterday, and I said to him, I said, hey, is that you on the backing vocals? I swear you can hear his nasally backing vocals say, go ahead, go ahead. Is he in there?
Yeah, he's in there.
I told him, I said, you stick out like a sore thumb. I love it. At the end of chorus one, we get a little two-bar, little turnaround that takes us into the reintro for eight bars. Again, drums, bass, stereo guitars, and the organ. Before we go into verse two is a half of verse, because the second half of it goes back to the chord progression without vocals. There's a new horn line that comes in, and I love that. Don't need no member to let yourself in. You don't need no language or color of skin. Don't need no money to make a contribution to be a part of the two-tone revolution.
Yeah, well, that's about the gist of it. And then we have the horns playing the vocal melody, basically, which I'm a big believer in. I like to have that where you have a verse, but it's you're using the horn section just to play around the melody on it. That's an old songwriting trick.
It is, and I'm calling it the bridge. It's kind of like a middle eight here that happens, but it is the chord progression of the chorus.
Yeah, so I call that a like a horn bridge is what I call it in my own buck speak. That's what I call a horn bridge. So it's kind of like a pre-bridge in a way, and essentially what it is, it's an instrumental verse with a little bit of messing around.
There you go. Well, coming off of that, we're into verse three, which is a double verse again. And there's some words here. I'd probably say 75-80% of the lyrics here are the same as verse one, but you changed some stuff up. And was that off the cuff, or was that how you did it live? Did you want to change it up? Do you remember why the lyrics were changed up here?
Yeah, I changed it up. And you know, by the time we got around to recording that tune in the studio, we'd already been playing it out live quite a lot. So it had changed in its inception quite a bit from what we thought we were going to record and what we ended up recording, because we'd already had put it in into the set as the encore. And so Cooley on, you know, when we're doing it live, Cooley had a section where he was just, you know, rapping over it. So it was kind of like the end was like freestyle. So I'm not sure that was what I was meant to sing, but that's what came out and it sounded good, so we just kept it.
Yeah, and those are, of course, the days that we did go out and we call it road testing new songs to see what kind of reaction you got. And, you know, that's where you practice them, and you didn't have to worry about them being on something called YouTube or whatever on the internet the very next second.
Yeah, the internet's destroyed everything, basically.
That's the sound clip where we're going to promote the episode. I love it. There's a new bug that's going around. Gonna blast shockwaves all over your town. Rough up your system and smash it down. That's a lyric change. It's a 90s beat on a 50s sound. They're wearing bomber flights, combat boots. They're wearing skater pants. They're wearing 60 suits. A couple different lyrics there. It's a lifestyle that is hard to refute. It looks real modern, but it's all about the roots.
That last lyric is a take from Chuck Berry, who's a massive influence on me, and it's from one of his lyrics. Let me see if I can remember how that goes. He has a song which is that he's saying, you got to remember your roots. I'm trying to remember what the exact lyric is, but I purloined a Chuck Berry lyric and bastardized it for that. And so that was a nod to Chuck Berry, about who we also wrote a song about him on that same album.
Well, on the second half of verse three here, the organ gets really playful. I like what it does here leading into chorus two, which is the same lyric repeated three times. Two-tone army, go ahead, with pretty much the same instrumentation as chorus one. Immediately following that, Buck, we go into another 16-bar reintro. And why not? The horn part is catchy as all get out, and it keeps people dancing. And again, it was all about live, right? You weren't going to do an 8-bar reintro here. Let's do it 16. The people are skanking. You got them in the palm of your hands now.
And in fact, you know, when we play it live, sometimes that's even doubled up, so that can run longer sometimes. At this point, most people know those lyrics, so we're throwing it out to the audience, and then we say two-tone army, and the audience is doing the go ahead.
Right, which is great for audience participation back and forth. Those kind of call and response sing-alongs are awesome. And I got to ask, you know, one of the most interesting parts of the song, Buck, is chorus three here, the outro, because you don't go back to the chorus progression. You just stay on that G, and it just, there's just this tension there. Did you ever go back to the regular chorus, or was it always this way?
Well, I think in a previous life it resolved, but it sounded better just to write it out because I thought, I don't remember if we did a fade on the album or not, but one of the intentions was to do that, and I think we just faded it out to the sound of just the marching boots.
Yeah, we'll get to that stomping in a second, which I want to talk more to you about because it's really, really cool. I just like how it makes me feel at the end. But there's a tension here on chorus three. And a lot of the stuff that, in particular, the Toasters, you were writing during this period, a lot of little pieces would remind me of 60s TV shows like Maxwell Smart or something. And I get that vibe here on this last chorus. It's like, it's because of that tension. You know, TV theme show songs would do that. You'd get the poppy chorus the first two times, but the last one would be a little bit weird with the same lyric.
Well, we have a track on that album also called Maxwell Smart. We play the Maxwell Smart theme. But I mean, when I grew up, I watched a lot of cartoons when I was a kid, like a lot. But I was always really interested about those types of soundtracks. And, you know, like I said, this whole album, just having the chance whilst we were writing it to be at the same time working on that cartoon show at the same time. I had a different set of musicians working on that project with, like, some of the Toasters, but also Buford O'Sullivan and Django Jeff Baker was working with, and Victor Rice on bass. And so it was kind of really, I was like immersed in a cartoon idiom on this project. And a lot of that flooded back into the Two-Tone Army album and gave us that influence there. So what you're hearing is a direct confluence of the two sessions I was working on simultaneously.
That is great. Well, we get on chorus three, basically two-tone army. Go ahead, go ahead. It happens 12 times. On the second time, the organ gets really playful, panned off to the left. The third time is the vocals. The fourth time, the organ gets playful again off to the left. The fifth through eighth times, the progression slightly changes, and the band is doing the staccato rhythm with the toms. It's like dun, 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 dun. This is happening in that section, which kind of just changes it up a little bit, but still you got that tension holding on those chords because it doesn't go back to the original chorus. At the end of the eighth time, we hear the feet stomping. They start to come in there.
Yeah.
And 9 through 11, the vocals are decaying over the next three times. Not the 9th, 10th, and 11th time that it happens. And then on 12, the very last time, you don't even really hear the vocals anymore. All we have left are the foot stomps that are fading away. And whose idea was that? How'd that come about?
That was actually a guy called Steve Schaefer, who was working at the label, said, oh, we should just have everybody come in and record the marching. And so basically we'd been working with a fade out on the track. And then as we were fading out the music, we were fading up the boots. So basically as the song tailed away, the boot marching fade was like coming up. So it just transitioned from the music just to the marching feet. And then we faded that back out. So the two-tone army showed up and marched off into the distance.
And I got to ask you, you know, you had been at it for a while at this point, about 15 years when this song came out, and you've written a number of great songs since then. One of my favorite songs is the title track from the very next record, Don't Let the Bastards Grind You Down, which you guys were playing every night on the Ska Against Racism tour. You've written a ton of fantastic tunes, but why this one? Why do you think this one has, you know, when you look at the Spotify and the YouTube numbers and everything, and it's just it's a huge fan favorite?
Well, I think it's because it was an anthem, you know, or a scanthem. And I thought, you know, I just want to write this tune as a sing-along. And I had no idea that it was, you know, going to be one of the most popular tunes. But I just think it caught people's imagination. And people like the fact that it's just like so inclusionary. Like everybody's welcome. You know, you don't have to be anything special to be a member of the two-tone army, just show up and we'll, like, you know, we'll make some space for you. So I think people like that. And just like out of the blue, it's a song that I didn't intend to write. It just kind of wrote itself by accident. And sometimes those are the best ones. You know, the songs you didn't set out to, like, spend too much time worrying about, oh, what's going to go here and how are we going to do this? The song that just wrote itself. And there you go.
Yeah, and isn't that amazing? I've had times in my life where someone will come up and, you know, a fan, they'll be talking about that weird B-side that was an album track, you know, and they want to hear that song. And I'm like, oh, the performance was awful, and this was awful, and that was awful. And I wrote it in 2 seconds, and that doesn't matter to that fan.
No.
It doesn't matter. They're just grooving on the tune, and it's been a long time since I've had that stinking thinking, I call it. I don't think about that stuff anymore. Where it's like, yeah, I put tons of time into this song and this album that nobody wants to listen to, but the song I wrote when I was 19 in 3 minutes, that's the one they gravitate to. But I can't change that.
It's pretty funny. There was this band in New York City called the Insteps back in the day, who were a great band, like on a trad style. And I was having a drink with one of those guys, and he's like, man, you really make me mad. I said, well, what you mean? He goes, well, we spend all this time like crafting these tunes, you know, we're like really spend hours to do this. And here you come out with a tune like Two Tone Army and everybody loves it. And you know, how do you do that? So dude, sometimes maybe it's best not to try too hard.
Absolutely. Well, listen, thank you so much for sitting in today, making time for the show. And what would you like to leave everybody listening? What's coming up with you and the Toasters?
Well, I'm taking a little bit of time off. Number one, because it's cold. I don't want to tour in the winter anymore. Mustard plugger out there this week. It's freezing their butts off. So we got some touring in April and May. I'll be in Florida in April and May. And then some festival stuff over the summer and a European tour in the fall. But I'm taking a little bit easy at the moment. My wife's got a heavy-duty job, so I'm kind of trying to give a little bit back to the family this year because I've been away so much. But I'll be hanging in there. You'll see me around.
Awesome. Well, thanks again.
Thanks, Chris.
Hey, everybody. Hope you all enjoyed that conversation with Bucket. But don't go anywhere. We got lots more Chris Makes a Podcast, including the band you might not know and the rap segment, coming right up after a few words from our sponsors.
Hey, what's up? My name's Lurk, and I'm the host of Lamb Goat's Van Flip Podcast. Every week, I have in-depth conversations with bands from all over the scene, big and small. We also like to keep our finger on the pulse and showcase up-and-coming bands on the show as well. So come check out Lamb Goat's Van Flip Podcast.
As we near the end of the show, here's a band you might not know.
Welcome to this week's Band You Might Not Know. If you'd like your band to be considered for Krista Makes a Podcast, email your best song and a short bio to bandyoumightnotknow@gmail.com. This week's featured artist is Croaker, a three-piece punk rock band from Northampton, England, featuring Alex on guitar and vocals, Joe on bass and vocals, and Rab on the drums. Here's a snippet of the title track of their most recent record, Living for the Sake of Living.
The Rap with Chris and Chris.
Chris, it's hard to imagine, for me, a time when ska and punk rock music weren't intertwined. And it sounds like, I didn't really know this, but it sounds like Bucket was like right at the forefront of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Toasters, you know, started out in 81, and I talked to them a little bit, like, what was going on back then? And they had to jump on punk shows. You know, there wasn't that a glut of ska bands to play with. And I even mentioned it to him, and we didn't really expound too much on it. But I think that, that's kind of where maybe ska punk was born out of. The ska bands had to play with, you know, other bands. They would play with the punks. You know, something else I didn't say to him that we got backlash from the trad ska kids, the traditional ska kids back in the 90s. You know, it's like, you're bastardizing the sound, and you know, it's disrespectful to the forefathers of Jamaican reggae and where this came from. And it was like, okay, well, you could look at it that way, but we're just these suburban kids that love the sound, and this is our interpretation of it. It was nothing more, nothing less.
It's funny to think back to the early 80s, and based on some of the ideals of what the music is all about, yes, it makes sense that punk and ska would come together as far as the scenes of music, but just the sounds of the music, if you go back to that time, it's hard to imagine. There's such different sounding music that the fact that at some point somebody decided to put those two sounds together, I don't know, it's just a wild thing to think about.
Well, yeah, and you know, and the Toasters weren't, you know, some people would probably label them traditional ska, but there was like this 50s rock and roll thing that they were kind of doing with it. So, you know, to me, it didn't sound like the Specials or Bad Manners or English Beat and some of the early traditional ska bands, but they definitely put their spin on it. And then, of course, you got into the Fishbones and the Operation Ivies and the Mighty Mighty Bosstones, and shortly thereafter, the Less Than Jakes and Goldfingers of the world.
Right. Yeah. And it makes sense that they would kind of be that bridge, because there is a rock element to the Toasters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not, it doesn't sound exactly like the Specials. There is a more rockin' aspect to it. So maybe they're that bridge that got us to where we got to in the 90s. I thought it was a pretty wild story about the Florida show that they played, and there were guys from the KKK that wanted to come in because they were fans of the Toasters. And the quote that I thought was crazy was, "We're not racists, we're just bigots." And I was like, wait a second, isn't bigot always a negative thing? And also, is there a difference? So Chris, I actually looked up, what is the difference between a bigot and a racist? And a bigot is a person who is generally intolerant and hateful toward people they consider different. And this could be in terms of race, religion, sexuality, or any other way. Whereas a racist is a specific type of bigot, one who's bigoted based on race. So saying you're a bigot, I don't know.
So a racist could, like homosexuals maybe or something, and but yet not like Hispanics,
right?
But bigot, covers it all.
Yeah, bigot is the umbrella. Yeah. That, and I don't know, it's all idiots.
Yeah,
that's
that was
for sure,
that was Archie Bunker's character was a bigot. You know, he was kind of
okay.
Yeah, I think that would sum up that term. But yeah, I don't know if Bucket was a little off, and maybe he wasn't. That just seems so unlike Gainesville at the time. I mean, we had some fringe religious groups outside of Gainesville. I remember there was a band called Elvis Hitler one time that came to play, and they protested that band because, you know, of Hitler and the name of the band. But I don't recall any KKK stuff. And, you know, Gainesville was the one place in Florida where you didn't really see the racist skinhead thing. Again, it was a very, very liberal town in mostly conservative Florida at that time. So I don't recall that ever happening, but if he says it did, I'm sure it did.
Yeah, it was just a wild story. Chris, when you were a kid, you got a few years on me. Were you a Nickelodeon kid?
No.
Did you watch Nick?
I didn't. I wasn't really, I mean, I've certainly watched it, but I wasn't glued to the TV. Again, when Nickelodeon was really happening in the 90s, I was stuck in a van.
Right, yeah. I was able to be a Nick kid. I just missed Kablam. At that point, I was like 15 or 16 years old, and I was like, I'm too cool for Nickelodeon. But I do remember this song, like hearing this song around, mm-hmm. you know, at that time because of that show. That is wild that the intentions were to write a song for the show, and then it ended up becoming one of the most popular Toasters song. It's such a, you never know where the inspiration's going to come from to write a cool song.
Absolutely. And, you know, this was 15 years into the band. They wrote their biggest song. You know, you think about that. 1996, they started in 81. So I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah. And the one more thing, and we've talked about this before, Chris, he talked about road testing the song. Like, you could play the song out and see how people responded to it before you recorded it. And that could be a big part of what then ends up being on the record. And this idea of road testing songs seems to be lost now. I think it gets lost once you're an established band. And then, you know, maybe you'll throw a new song here and there, but you want to play the songs that people know for the most part. So road testing isn't really a thing, except for before you release your first album and everything is being road tested. But I thought that was pretty cool that they got a chance to work some things out in a live environment that then became part of the recorded song.
Absolutely, because, you know, as I said to Bucket, they're first and foremost, they're a live band, so it would make sense to road test it in front of your tried and tested fan base, your audience that loves you. And speaking of audiences that love you, Chris.
Nice yeah. segue. I was gonna jump in and do that.
That's right. If you like the way Chris and I our rapport with each other, please visit chrisdemakes.com and you can sign up for our supporting cast, which is basically our VIP Patreon program, and you can get bonus episodes each week of The After Party, which is our little offshoot podcast Chris and I do for a very small little fee. Head over to chrisdemakes.com and join us. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, we really appreciate it. You help keep the lights on over here, and not only do you get a bonus episode every week, but at this point, we've been doing the After Party podcast for years. There are tons of back episodes. We do a lot of fun ones. What's your favorite TV theme song? We do trivia episodes. We do all kind of stuff. Music history in general, and I don't know. If you like Krista Makes a Podcast, I'm pretty sure you're going to like The After Party. So yeah, KristaMakes.com is the place to go for that.
Thank you for your support. And we also have a Krista Makes a Podcast Instagram page now. My friend Chris here is putting a lot of cool clips up there. So go check that out and give us a follow. Krista Makes a Podcast Instagram page. And I want to thank this week's guest, Rob Bucket Hingley from The Toasters. And we'll see you next week.
I don't think it overstates things to say that the Beatles were the greatest gift to entertainment and culture of our time, a secular religion, if you will, with their universal appeal and demonstrable impact on people's lives. I'm Robert Rodriguez, host of Something About the Beatles. With every episode, I speak with historians, musicians, artists, and Beatle witnesses all in the service of fresh insights into the most joyous cultural entity the world has ever known. I hope you'll join me and listen to Something About the Beatles, now on Evergreen and wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, this is Chad Nicefield.
And this is Justin Press.
We're the host of Making Waves, the Shiprock podcast, a part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. We're inviting you to sail away with us on an epic journey in musical enlightenment. Every week, we bring you only the best artists in rock music and discuss everything from the cruise to the stage to the saga of being a professional recording artist. We'll have lots of special guests along the way, so tune in every week.
Your stateroom is available every Monday morning, so welcome aboard.